Welcome to Computing Lives, a podcast from the IEEE Annals of the History of Computing. This is the fourth and final installment in a four-part series on the invention of the Intel 4004 computer. At the end of the last episode, we had just seen Intel sell its concept of a new set of processor chips to the Japanese calculator company, Busicom. The Japanese engineer, Shima, accepted the decision gracefully and began to work with Mazur to solve what he regarded as the shortcoming of Ted Hoff's design. This work was completed at the end of 1969, and Shima returned to Japan in December of that year to finalize the programming and documentation. Over the next several months, he worked on some of the programming detail, a product manual, product specifications, and some of the hardware architecture. By the end of March 1970, Shima had completed this work. He returned to California in April to see how Intel was progressing at turning the architectural design into silicon products, as well as to finalize the last few details in the contract between Intel and Busicom. He was distressed to learn that virtually no progress was being made. This delayed Intel seriously undermined Busicom's schedule to build its calculator line and jeopardize its market competitiveness. "I visited Intel once again," Shima said. "This time I was told from Busicom that my main job was just to check what Intel was doing. When I went to Intel, I found they had not done anything. We fought it quite strongly because Busicom paid money, and Busicom sent all the documents on each LSI product. And at that time, when I went to Intel, nothing was done. I was mad." Intel management had pulled Hoff from the project to work on another contract to develop a chip to serve the central processor for an intelligent computer terminal, the DataPoint 2200, for Computer Terminal Corporation, a project that ultimately resulted in another, more powerful microprocessor known as the 8008. Shima was not informed of the fact that Hoff had transferred to another project until he arrived in the United States that April. He took out his anger on the project's new chip designer, Fagan, until he learned that Fagan had joined Intel only a week before and did not even know any of the details of the project. Hoff's redeployment was a reasonable management decision for Intel. Hoff was manager of the applications research department and was skilled at the application assets of the development process, but not in the details of chip layout and fabrication. When Hoff was reassigned, the setting of the design and silicon for Busicom was turned over to Les Vadas, head of Intel's MOS design team. Vadas and his staff were too preoccupied with Intel's principal business, the design of memory chips, to do much work on the Busicom chipset. Moreover, their experience was in memory chip rather than in logic chip design. It was clear they needed to hire someone with appropriate experience to carry out the Busicom project, but it took them 6 months to do so. Partly it was because there was a shortage of qualified chip designers available for hire. Apparently it was also partly because Vadas was reluctant to hire the most qualified available person, Fagan, because of the friction between them when they had worked together at Fairchild. Another reason may have been that Intel did not regard the Busicom contract as a high priority and did not then see a place for the microprocessor in Intel's future. Eventually, Intel did hire Fagan, who proved to be an excellent choice for the next stage of the project. He had received a PhD in physics in 1965 from the University of Padua. His lectures in physics for a year at the university before holding positions in several Italian companies, where he helped develop an early processor technology for MOS devices. He came on exchange to Fairchild in the United States in 1968, where he played a major role in developing new silicon gate technology for fabricating high-performance, high-density MOS integrated circuits. Intel hired Fagan in April 1970, expressly to work on the Busicom project, with the understanding that the architecture and logic design were already completed and only some circuit design and chip layout remained to be done. However, he found the project much less advanced than he had been led to believe. Many architectural and logic design issues were still unresolved, and he found the Intel staff to be little help in resolving these issues. With some assistance from Shima and Mazur, Fagan worked furiously for the next year on the project, often putting 12 and 16-hour days. He's indicated that "I wanted so badly to do a good job that I almost worked myself to death to meet the schedule." He resolved the remaining architectural problems, prepared the final logic and circuit designs, and developed a new process for laying out the four chips. The 4001, read-only memory, was completed in October 1970. The 4002, random access memory, and the 4003 shift register the following month, with very few flaws appearing. There were minor problems with the 4004 central processing unit, and the masks were not perfected until February 1971. By March, full chipsets were sent to Bizicom for testing. A set consisting of four 4001s, two 4002s, two 4003s, and a single 4004. The speed at which Fagan was able to complete his work and the high quality of the results he produced are great testaments to his ability and effort. Shima remained at Intel from April until November 1970. During this time, he worked on a detailed logic schematic that he believes to have been instrumental in the chip layout. He also worked on logic simulation and on a test program, which was used to verify that the set worked properly. Between April and October, Shima's colleague, Masuda, developed a breadboard of the calculator based on the logic schematic that Shima had prepared while at Intel. In December 1970 and January 1971, Shima used this breadboard to build a prototype of the printer desktop calculator. In March 71, he was able to rebuild the prototype into a fully functional model using the 4004 chip made at Intel. Starting in April, Bizicom began the manufacture of calculators, billing machines, cash registers, and teller machines based on the new technology. Most of these machines were manufactured on an original equipment manufacturer basis with NCR as the main customer. Sales reached 100,000 units. Bizicom made some use of the flexibility of the microprocessor approach by using microprogramming to introduce new features into several of the calculator models, a flexibility the customers apparently appreciated. But Hoff has argued that the microprocessor design did not have major importance to Bizicom. He said, probably the general purpose capability of the microprocessor had not much economic value to Bizicom. The only advantage in the calculator business was in the smaller number of designs, higher volume, and lower cost of production, getting down the learning curve faster. On the other hand, there was no guarantee that the original Bizicom design would have been any better, and maybe it would have been a lot worse. More interesting is the fate of the microprocessor at Intel. During the development of the chipset, Fagan had felt that he always had to struggle for resources. One possible reason for having to fight for those resources is that there was a lack of understanding at the more senior management level. Possibly the company just didn't have the resources to give. Maybe this project was not considered important as the memory chips they were working on. There was also a recession in 1970. Chip orders had not increased as rapidly as Intel had expected, and Intel was strapped for cash. The company laid off workers and delayed moving into its new headquarters building. Memory rather than logic chips remained the company's main interest. In any event, under the terms of the contract, Intel could manufacture only the chipset, including the 4004 microprocessor, for Bizicom's use. There was no opportunity at this time for Intel to build a business manufacturing and selling microprocessors. The situation changed rapidly, however. Other Japanese manufacturers were producing calculators in high volume, and Bizicom felt it had to lower its calculators' prices in order to remain competitive. As early as April 1971, just 2 months after Fagan had produced a complete working chipset, Bizicom management approached Intel with a request to renegotiate the contract. Fagan recommended to Intel President Noyce that Intel renegotiate, giving price concessions in exchanges for abrogating the exclusivity clause. Hoff made a similar request. I talked to our marketing people who are going to Japan. Our marketing people did not seem terribly enthused when I asked them to negotiate for those rights, but they did indeed negotiate for them, and they came back in May with the rights. These rights came in two stages, each with a price concession to Bizicom. At first, Intel had limited rights to sell the chipset as long as it was not sold to other calculator manufacturers. And later, Intel gained universal rights to sell the chipset, which it called the MCS4, short for Microcomputer System 4-bit. Fagan disputes Hoff's role. I started pushing management to go into the open market with that chip. Now, Ted Hoff is saying that he is the one doing it, but he actually was against it. He was telling everybody that it was only good for calculators. So I took it upon myself to show management that I could actually solve other mechanical problems using the 4004. when it was time to develop the production tester for the 4004, I used the 4004 as a controller and used that to say, now tell me that it's only good for calculators. I built a lot of momentum inside the company to actually go to market the 4004. Although Intel had gained the right to sell the microprocessor, the company did not do much to exercise that right. At first, the company did not seem to recognize the potential for the microprocessor. Marketing viewed the microprocessor narrowly, as only a direct competitor to the mini computer. But nothing was done to follow the negotiated rights to market the MCS4. And there was a lot of negative feeling within Intel, primarily in marketing. One marketing guy said, "The total sale of mini computers is 20,000. We are latecomers to the business, so we are lucky to get 10% of it. 2,000 customers is not worth all this." The other position was that even if we announced the product, computers take a lot of staff support, and we have no way to do this. Some of these strategies were discussed. The argument was given that we can handhold a few key customers and the rest of them will be on their own. But a lot of people who buy mini computers are on their own. They get a manual, and we could put together a manual with examples how to program it. But basically, customers were to be on their own. The senior management was no more certain than the marketing department of the value of the new product. Huff remembers having a meeting with Noyce and others. Huff said, "They had a tiger by the tail and did not know how to handle it. They were just reluctant to make a decision." Noyce and Huff indicate that this uncertainty was paralleled in Intel's board of directors. There was debate, though, as to whether Intel should exercise its new option. Some members of the board of directors were not certain the company should venture into systems business. In the end, the view of Arthur Rock, chairman of the board, prevailed, and the board endorsed the venture. The change took place at about the time when Intel hired a new marketing director, Ed Gelbach. He had previously been at Texas Instruments, which had shown interest in logic devices. In fact, work by Gary Boone and others on microprocessor was already well underway at Texas Instruments when Gelbach joined Intel. Gelbach swept away the concerns formerly expressed by marketing and helped push Intel into the microprocessor business. One of the most compelling arguments made inside the company at the time was that customers would need memory devices to attach to the microprocessor, so the microprocessor was regarded as a way of enhancing the market for Intel's primary business interest. On the 15th of November, 1971, the issue of trade journal Electronic News, Intel ran a large advertisement announcing a new era of integrated electronics. At the Fall Joint Computer Conference held in Las Vegas, Nevada, that same month, Intel staffed a suite where it distributed information about the MCS4. Customers came in and really inundated them, wanting to know what this computer on a chip thing. Intel received 5,000 responses to the Electronic News announcement, far greater response than to any previous product announcement. In 1971, Hoff and Mazur went on the road in the United States and Fagan in Europe, giving talks about the MCS4. Hoff remembers standing room only crowds and on many occasions having to relocate these meetings to larger lecture rooms. Certainly by the end of 1971, Intel marketing and senior management recognized the value of the new product. By late 72, the technical press was taking notice and companies such as National Semiconductor and Rockwell were beginning to build their own microprocessors. By the mid-1970s, the business media were paying attention to the microprocessor, led by a major article in Fortune. By the end of the decade, public interest had been captured. Fagan had pointed out that marketing a microprocessor is more difficult than marketing a conventional electronic component. In order to market the microprocessor, Intel had to produce not only the data sheets giving the product specification, but also a programming manual, application notes showing how to use the components, a development board capable of implementing a functional prototype of the hardware, and a cross-assembler, that is to say, a program running on a mini-computer that enabled the conversion from instruction mnemonics into machine language. Most difficult of all, one had to teach applications engineers to change their approach to design, to seek software rather than hardware solutions. For a while, Intel spent more on printing and mailing manuals, trying to interest application engineers, than it gained in revenue from microprocessor sales. The company was able to turn this marketing difficulty into a business opportunity, however, by developing design tools, such as prototyping boards, and software assembly and simulators, which it sold to application developers. In the first few years, these design tours were more profitable than the sale of microprocessors themselves. The difficulty of teaching application engineers to program rather than hardwire their logic functions was compounded by the limited capabilities of the 4004 processor. The application to the calculator was obvious, but for what else was the 4004 appropriate? The answer, Intel decided, was embedded control. Intel set about to create a market concentrating first in business machines, aviation, and medical applications, and test equipment. For example, the 4004 was placed in test equipment so that engineers would not burn their equipment by setting the dials incorrectly. Intel also saw opportunities for using microprocessors as controllers in durable consumer goods such as washing machines and microwave ovens. The company solicited application suggestions from its customers, including one who told them of attaching microprocessors to cows to monitor water and salt consumption and milk production. The conclusion of the story. Intel has had an impressive history as both a technical innovator and a profitable business, and has every right to be proud of its role in the development of the microprocessor. However, several claims that seem to have become accepted lore in the engineering community do not hold up under historical scrutiny. One is that Intel invented the microprocessor. If one means by this statement that the company was the first to conceive of the microprocessor and introduce the concept to industry, then it's quite clear that this claim is false. The stored program computer, which was used prominently as a calculator in the 1950s and 60s, was one of the most lauded achievements of the post-war era and was familiar to every engineer working in the semiconductor industry. That industry itself had the computer as its most prominent application area. With the scale of integration on chips doubling every year, by the 1960s, the technology was reaching the point where it was technically feasible to build a central processing unit on a chip. We have seen, not surprisingly, that a number of different groups independently came to Hoff's concept of a computer on a chip. It's clear that what was important in the invention of the microprocessor was not the conceptualization, but rather the implementation of an economically sound product. On these grounds, Intel has the stronger claim. It was the first company to successfully build and commercialize a microprocessor product. It recognized an application where it made both technical and economic sense to use the microprocessor, and it carried forth the product successfully. But it must also be remembered that Busicom provided the application and the funding to carry out the development and the stimulus to Intel to complete the project after the funding had been supplied. The behind-the-scenes role of Sharp as a technological entrepreneur, a fact that was completely unknown to the other principals, should also be remembered. In fact, Sasaki also provided startup funding to Fagan when he founded the rival microprocessor firm Zilog. A second piece of lore that merits historical reinterpretation is Intel's foresight in developing the microprocessor. The evidence indicates that the Busicom project was attractive to Intel not because of the important new technology the project would develop, but primarily because it was a cash cow that would enable the company to continue its operations while it pursued principal interest in semiconductor computer memories. Even after the MCS4 chipset had been successfully completed, the company did not first fully recognize the potential of microprocessors. Marketing reaction ranged from unenthusiastic to hostile, senior management was indecisive in promoting the technology, and the technical people had only an inkling of the range of applications for which microprocessors might be used. It took no more than a year for these initial positions to change, but it was only with its third microprocessor project, the 8080, that Intel made sufficient commitment to this field to invest its own money in the development. A third piece of common lore is to assign the invention of the microprocessor solely to Hoff. This is intended no way to disparage Hoff, a truly remarkable engineer, but it must be remembered that Hoff's contribution was primarily to have one good idea about how to reconceptualize the existing project, making economical use of the microprocessor and then to work for a short period of time to flesh out the architectural design without completing it. Much of the hard work in logic design, chip layout and fabrication, and customization to application were accomplished by Shima and Fagan with little, if any, of Hoff's assistance. Fagan remembers that Hoff seemed to have lost interest in the Busicom project after he moved on to the 8008 project, and there was little contact with Hoff as Fagan worked feverishly to make the chipset a reality. There may be many reasons why Hoff has been given so much credit for the microprocessor. People need to have heroes and simple stories to tell and remember, and a sole inventive genius conforms to this need. Western culture appreciates scientific feats more than engineering ones, so it's not surprising that greater credit is awarded to conceptualization than to implementation. It's also been suggested that Intel's powerful public relations machine has done little to disabuse the notion that people who remain close to the company, Hoff, deserve more credit than others who moved on to rival firms, Fagan, although it's beyond the scope of this paper to evaluate this claim. It's difficult to apportion credit fairly to the other principal participants in the story. This has been a contentious issue for many years, and Fagan, Hoff, and Shima have decidedly different viewpoints on this matter. A lot of controversy may be explained by the different interests and backgrounds of the actors, which had led them to different sets of priorities and values. It's clear that Fagan rescued the Bizicom project and worked long and hard to make it a success. He seems to have made major contributions to the architectural, logical, and circuit designs and to have almost single-handedly been responsible for the chip layout and fabrication. Over the next several years, Fagan managed Intel's growing microprocessor business, which amounted to approximately 30% of the company's sales by 1974. He was the co-founder and chief executive officer of Zilog in 1974, which was a very important manufacturer of semiconductor devices for the early personal computer industry and a formidable competitor to Intel for a while. He was entrepreneurial, managerial, and technical abilities in semiconductors have continued to show his current startup firm, Synaptics. It's much more difficult to evaluate Shimi's contribution. Shima has written his personal account of his role in the development of the microprocessor, in which he assigns himself a central position in the development of the 4004, the 8080, the Z80, and the Z8000 microprocessors. However, in interviews, Sasaki, Fagan, and Hoff have strongly disputed Shima's claims. Shima correctly claims that he was the designer of the original Bizicom plan, important elements of which were incorporated into the chipset Intel built. Shima also correctly claims that Intel did not have organizational capability in logic chip design, at least until Fagan was hired, and that he provided the skill to the project at a critical time. Even if his capability of a self-taught variety. Shima was the principal conduit for the knowledge of the application, which shaped many aspects of the design. He was an important catalyst in pursuing Intel to follow through on its contractual commitment to Intel. And later he played an important role in designing the chipset into a line of Bizicom products, even though they were ultimately not enough to prevent Bizicom from going out of business. Shima was much in demand. Intel courted him to work on the redesign of the clunky 8008 microprocessor into the more successful 8080 microprocessor. Fagan hired Shima away from Intel to work for Zilog, where he played a useful role in the development of the highly successful Z80 and Z8000 microprocessors. Later, when he decided to return to his native country, Intel accommodated him by creating a new laboratory in Japan. However, there's another side to the Shima story. Hoff and Fagan credit Shima with being an excellent detail man, but not being someone who made any essential contributions to the conception or design. Fagan referred to Shima as a super technician with machine-like virtues. Shima is almost like a computer in the sense that he does not make mistakes. He can teach you talents. You can almost always rely on what he says, "Yes, I'm finished." You will find no mistakes in that work. He was an incredibly strong right hand. With Shima, I would say to do it this way, and it would be done. I would say, check my work. Here is the way I want the logic to be done. Clear the tables. Do this, do that. And I would rely on him. Other people also had a role in the development of the microprocessor. Shima credits Mazur as an important go-between to Hoff, especially when Shima's English languages were weak. Gelbach seems to have turned around the attitude towards the microprocessors in the marketing department and to have installed some of the interest Texas Instruments had in logic devices into the memory-oriented Intel culture. The contribution of Noyce as president remains unclear, but it is apparent that he played an important background role throughout this story. In Japan, Murakami and Sasaki were important background figures. The story is most appropriately told as one of many individuals, Japanese and American, working sometimes together and other times at cross purposes to socially construct the microprocessor. You've been listening to Computing Lives. This podcast is one of four that is based on an essay written by Bill Asprey, which appeared in Volume 19, Number 3 of the Annals of the History of Computing. The other podcasts in this series are available from the Computer Society's podcast site, which is www.computer.org/podcasts. You can find all of the Computer Society's podcasts there. You can find more about the Annals, as well as other Computer Society publications, at www.computer.org. If you want to find the Annals, click on the Publications tab and go to Technical Magazines. If you have any comments, you can send them to podcasts@computer.org. The music for this podcast came from the Podshow PodSafe Music Network, which you can find at music.podshow.com. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.